The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
What I'd like to do this time is to, first of all, go over a little bit about what we want to do with a course like this and decide to survive it. I'll sit down. Is it all right if I sit down? I hate groups like this. It gives me culture shock. What on earth is contextual theology? Who on earth knows? Next question. Why are we studying this if nobody knows what it is? To keep you all busy and off the streets and out of trouble. And to make sure that my salary gets paid. Now, what will we do? The course objective in this thing is to understand the major theological and cultural issues involved in contextualization with some attention to case studies. Now, this is sufficiently vague to allow me to do anything under the sun. But it sounds great when you read it on paper, right? What we're basically going to try, this word contextual theology or contextualization as a concept is, at least as a formal technical term, is something kind of new. You'll find out in the next couple of sessions. It is probably right now in mission circles the most debated theological issue we've got. And what is interesting, especially in the last 2 or 3 years, is that now this issue, which began as a mission issue, is now being actually debated by theologians. I mean, this is wonderful to behold. And they know nothing about it, but they debate it with furor. Now, our effort will be to try and get a handle on something of the issues that revolve around this kind of topic. And then, especially, what I'm concerned about is to give you some practice in doing it. To give you some practice in terms of case studies we're going to set up. You get some on-hands experience in terms of wrestling with what some of these issues mean. That basically is hopefully how we'll go with a course like this. I'm used to working with a considerably smaller group and also with folks who come from all kinds of cultural settings. And we do have a lot of folks like that in this class, I know. So I'm probably going to pick on them more than anybody else to give us some help in trying to get this from being non-white. In terms of the course goals, then, there's really basically roughly about three, as I see it now, where we work with. Number one, to sketch the history and recent developments that have revolved around this topic. That'll take us through probably a couple of sessions, maybe even longer, depending on how wound up we all are, or how unwound I can get you as quickly as possible. Then, after that, to take a look at what are some of the issues involved in something like this. What are some of the things that people are writing and thinking about this topic? What are some samples of so-called contextual theology? And we want to deal with that too in this course. And then finally, and this is important to me, to provide the student with opportunities to test his or her theories by sample attempts at the contextualization theology. Now, what I hope you're going to do is, that as those of you taking this course for credit, there's no final examination this course. There'll be one paper, and that's your entire grade will come from that one paper. But that paper is to fulfill particularly what we've got in mind with that third objective. Your third paper will be your effort to contextualize and to produce a creed that will fit a particular culture. Okay?
Boy.
All right. We'll loosen this group up. Now, our reading assignments. A usual, typical course here, massive. Read the first 8,000 pages, please, by the next class session. Basically, it's not really, there's not that many. For example, a lot of the things, items C, D, E, and F are all very brief stuff. If I can find them here, they're so brief they're lost in the notes. I've asked you to read. Yes, they are lost. there we go. There's a book by John Stott, edited by John Stott and Bob Koot, called Down to Earth. You'll notice you're asked to read in that approximately 30 pages. This is at the end of that book. It's called The Willowbank Report, and it deals with the gospel and culture. It's a sort of a summary of all of the papers contained in that book. And it's a very significant one. You're asked to read that report, not the whole book. Then the other items are all examples of recent creeds that have been written in various parts of the world. And we're going to have you read those creeds. The last requirement on the list is asking you to read at least 500 pages. And you pick whatever you want. Okay? These 500 pages of reading, which you select in the area of your particular interest. And you'll do that reading in connection with the term paper. What should the term paper be? Some of you will come from ordinarily when I teach this course, we work with a smaller group, almost all of which come from very different backgrounds. Usually it's a group of overseas people, and we've got maybe six or seven different backgrounds among four or five people. So this is not too difficult to make the suggestions. But what I'm asking you to do is I'm asking you to select an area of cultural interest. To aim or zero in on one particular culture. Maybe for Hilton it's going to be some aspect of Brazil. For some of us it's going to be the black culture. For others it could be, say, the Chinese-American community in the United States. For others, for example, it might be the yuppie culture, the growing yuppie culture in the United States. And you are to focus in on that particular culture. You are to read, to study everything you can find about that culture. What makes it tick? What are the things it's interested in? How does it put together its world? Then after you've done that in this paper, because all the papers are to follow roughly the same outline, the paper then will first of all sort of sketch in that kind of world. That's the world you're going to look at. The people who live in that cultural world. What makes them tick? Why do they think the way they do? Why do they feel the way they do? And through your reading, you're to try and explain that to me and yourself. Then in the second part of the paper, then you make an effort to suggest ways in which the gospel can be contextualized to this culture. That can be very practical, some how-to-do-it stuff. I leave that up to you, how you're going to work that out. And finally, in the final part, you are to write a creed. In the final part of the paper, you are to write a creed that you could use within that culture. A creed that would clearly set forth the gospel, but within the demands and within the sort of worldview of that culture. and I'm going to be very tough on you if it sounds too much like some that I've read many a time before. You're to use your imagination, and you're to work. The point of all this is you're to work from the inside out. The I advise you very strongly when you do this, don't read to the Heidelberg Catechism. Don't read to the Westminster Catechism. Don't sit down and decide, I better look, is there anything I've left out? Don't do that. This creed is to be written, the idea behind this is to be written from the inside out. And it's to be written in terms of the kind of people that you want to reach for Christ. All right, how are you going to do it with this kind of creed? Okay? So this is a chance for you to try this kind of contextualization. I warn you now, it is extremely difficult. This is going to be the toughest part of your assignment. Yeah. Well, this is what I'd suggest you do. Maybe at the present time, this assignment seems difficult. I think, for example, if you read, some of those essays in the book by Samuel and Sugden, that may give you the beginnings of some ideas. And as we talk about this, maybe what I mean will become clearer. But let me give you one small sample now to help, if I can help you with this. In the Muslim world, one of the principal objections that a Muslim has to the gospel is the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, the reason the Muslim objects to the doctrine of the Trinity is because to the Muslim, the Christian believes in three gods. The Muslim believes that when we as Christians use the term Trinity, we are thinking of three separate gods. And those three gods are the Father, Jesus, and the Virgin Mary. That is how the Muslim perceives us whenever we use the word Trinity. The Muslim further believes that when we use the word Trinity, what we have in mind is that the Father came down and physically impregnated the Virgin Mary and Jesus was born. And says the Muslim, that's your Christian concept of the Trinity. Now it isn't, but that's how the Muslim thinks we believe. How would you present the doctrine of the Trinity to a Muslim? When you know that the Muslim believes that. Or, for example, the Muslim believes also that, according to the Quran, Jesus did not die on the cross. According to the Quran, and the most popular interpretation of this particular verse in the Quran, Jesus was about to be crucified, and then at the last minute the Jews substituted Judas Iscariot, who died on the cross in the place of Jesus. For the Muslim, the idea of the vicarious atonement of Jesus is impossible. He never died. The Muslim believes that Jesus ascended bodily into heaven without ever seeing death. And the Muslim believes that Jesus will come again to judge the living and the dead. Now, how would you write a creed for a Muslim who believes that? In which you want to present the gospel, the heart of the gospel, that Jesus died and rose again for sinners. But you know the Muslim objects immediately to the idea of the physical death of Jesus. How would you do it? Yeah, right. I think that's a danger. The other danger is that the gospel would become so universalized that it has no cultural meaning at all. I think that's the danger with most evangelicals. But we Gnosticize the gospel so that it's removed totally out of any kind of history at all. Both are dangerous. You have to struggle with the middle. We're getting now into the whole course, and I don't want to do that. One of the advantages of doing this experiment in writing this creed is to help you wrestle with the fact that it's not easy. Now, it's because you're doing it. Ordinarily, creeds should never be written by one person. They should be written by the body of Christ together. You know, as the Lord's people have prayed, thought about their context, their situation, thought about how to share Christ in their situation, then the Lord's people together write that creed. So it becomes an expression of our common faith in Christ. Now, we can't do that in this class, and I know this is very artificial, so... But it may be helpful because you're going to realize how tough it is to do. And you're going to realize how tough it is to really make it sound authentic and genuine in the setting in which it's put. Let me give you one more sample, just if this may at least, I hope it clouds the issue a little. When you read, for example, this 30th Annual Declaration of the Reformed Church in Japan. Right, this is a traditional Reformed church, and this is what will be the beginning of their confession of faith. They hope to finish this project in 1986. They will have written in a full confession of their faith. What is startling about this is that this is the opening chapter. The opening chapter is not on the Bible. The opening chapter is not on the nature of God. The opening chapter is not on who is Jesus. The opening chapter is on the church and the state. Why? Why don't they start with God? Why don't they have a chapter on Jesus? Why don't they start with the Bible? Because they're going to be contextual. Why? I'll let you struggle as you read the creed. But maybe that's what we can say right now. And I think as you wrestle with these things, maybe if it isn't getting clearer for you, keep asking. Okay, brother? All right. Any questions any further? I hate to almost answer that question at this stage, but the answer I'll give, and then maybe later we can talk about why, the answer I'll give is that skip the evangelical stuff. What you want to read are what the non-Christians are saying. And the reason, let me just say it now then, I see a creed as basically an evangelistic tool. All creeds are that. They are confessions of faith. And they're not simply confessions of faith to your brother and sister Christians. The basic nature of the creed is it's a confession of faith to the non-Christian world. And that's the world that you've got to understand. When you start writing creeds to your other Christians who don't quite believe the way you do, you have a church that's, if not already dead, is in the process of dying. It's busy sort of telling everybody why it's not this group over there. But a creed, historically, is a confession. Just like I confess my faith in Christ, the Lord will confess my name before his Father in heaven. That's what I'm thinking of. So stick to that non-Christian world out there. Mark, did you have a...
Well, now I'm wondering, when we write our papers, do we interact with non-Christians or non-evangelicals? So there's like two parts of the paper, the creeds, which were interacting with culture, and the other
parts. Okay, I see what you mean. Right. I think I'd rather leave that up to you, because one sense it's tough to answer that. It depends what culture you're going to zero in on. Again, you see, here in the West, in the white world, we're working with a sort of a what some have called a post-Christian situation. You know, we have gone through sort of pass through the experience of having examined Christianity and being examined by Christianity, and now we've moved out of it. So we live in a culture that's been touched by Christianity, and as a result, we've got all these Christian type theologians. A setting like that, we've got to respond to some degree those people. But for example, if you're going to start working in a Muslim culture. I mean, there's very little need to deal with that kind of question because you've got no church in a Muslim culture. North Africa, there's two entire congregations now in all of North Africa. So the picture's a little different depending on the culture you're in. Or Thailand, where Henry Bridenthal comes from here. Here's Thailand, where the Christian population is 1% of the entire population. And the major question you must deal with in the Thai situation is Buddhism. Your creed, your confession, must interact constantly with the themes of Buddhism for it to be heard within the Thai culture. or if you're in another setting, let's say the you're in a setting like the People's Republic of China, and you're going to write a creed that will say something in that setting. All right, it's not going to be Confucianism you interact with, and it's not going to be Buddhism. It's going to be the concept of the state. And how do you interact with the whole idea of an ideology? How do you present Jesus as the answer to human ideologies? Suddenly, it's a political framework. So that the contexts are all going to be different. That's one of the fun things is you read those essays in the Samuel Sugden collection, because they're all different, and the sounds of them are different, but because the settings they're dealing with are different. For example, in Latin America, one of the real issues that's drawn attention to in this collection is the whole question of power and powerlessness in Latin America. You know enough about liberation theology to know that those questions of power, oppression, are at the very heart of a lot of the theologizing that's going on in Latin America now. All right, maybe you don't like liberation theology. Give me an evangelical alternative. Why has liberation theology arisen in Latin America? Well, because they're trying to deal with the tremendous disparity of wealth in that context. With in some countries where less than 4% of the population controlled 95% of the wealth of that country, where there is vast questions of human oppression, so that presenting the gospel in that setting demands that you have to deal with those kinds of questions. How will you set Jesus out? Liberation theology is insisting, whatever it's called, it's saying you have to set, in that setting, you talk about Jesus as the liberator. You may not like how it's done, but it is one effort to respond to the culture, to the context. I think that's what you're going to find, the diversity of all these situations. In black theology, there's a difference. For example, two of the most prominent black theologians are James Cone and Diotis Roberts. Diotis Roberts is now teaching at Eastern Baptist Seminary. There is quite a debate that has gone on in the literature between James Cone and Diotis Roberts. James Cone writes a book. Diotis Roberts writes another book refuting James Cone. Then James Cone refutes Diotis Roberts. Then Diotis Roberts refutes James Cone's refutation. It goes on like this. But I think the big difference between the two men is that Cone says that in a black culture in the United States, where racism is a constant struggle, that we must present Jesus as the liberator. So Cone writes a book sort of rewriting all of systematic theology and calls it A Black Theology of Liberation. And then Diotis Roberts writes, who I think is an evangelical, and Diotis Roberts says, look, it's not enough to preach Jesus as the liberator. We must also preach Jesus as the reconciler. And he attacks James Cone because he thinks that Cone is minimizing the message of reconciliation between the races. And so Roberts, one of his first books was called Liberation and Reconciliation. There's a debate going on between those men as to how to preach Christ in the black culture. Those are, I think, samples of how these people are attempting to deal with their different situations. And so you sort of put yourself in it, try and figure out which way the wind's blowing and how you can blow with it. Does this give you any more ideas? Ian, were you? Okay. Okay. Let's take a minute and look at some of the bibliography. Now, I didn't... this bibliography... I should mention some of you came in a little bit late, and we don't have enough of the bibliography or the course things made. So if you don't have a copy and would like it, there's a paper floating around somewhere. Oh, okay. Put your name on the paper, and then I'll see tomorrow that you get copies of all these. We'll just have extras made, and I'll put them in your boxes. Okay, here's the bibliography. You'll notice, first of all, it's broken down into general materials, and then from page 3 on, it breaks down into different groupings of theologies depending on your geographical location. So, for example, we've got about 3 pages on African theologies. One of the big disadvantages we have in this class is the language limitations. So we're limited in terms of what we can study to African theologies, let's say, written in Western languages. That's a big disadvantage for us because it very often colors and bends, twists the way we'll understand some of these movements. From page 6 and following, there is a long list of stuff on Asian theologies. The term Asian is just about as ambiguous as the term African, because in Asia you've got Indian theology, which has a rich history of development. The Indian church, as old as the apostles, and a rich legacy of a lot of theological discussion going on there. Then you've got the Philippines, the discussions going on with various religions, with Buddhism, etc. Some of the theological developments, more recent developments, for example, in Korea and Japan, very interesting. On page 8 and following, there is material on the Latin America theologies. And here I have put some Latin America, some Spanish language materials in for those who can use that. Then on page 11, called India and the Latin Captivity of the Church. Boyd is an evangelical, a member of the Church of England, and for many years a missionary in India. That book is a fascinating study of how Latin has affected the way we read theology. And he talks, for example, you know, the formulations in Western creeds constantly makes use of Latinization, right? We talk about three persons of the Trinity. Now, that's the term we use in contemporary English, but of course the meaning it has now and the meaning it had when it was originally used are radically different, right? Is there some way, and his point is that very often the language we use deeply affects the way we do theology. It affects the way we see things. That's the significance of the subtitle of this book, The Cultural Context of the Gospel. It's an interesting book. Make you wrestle a bit with this stuff. Is there a way, what about the Hellenization of Christian theology? In the first and second book. Then on page 11 and following is our, at least about a page and a half on black theologies. And I'll be glad to, in any of these areas, I'll be glad to help anybody who wants to, needs advice about where they should go or what they should look into. Okay? Okay. Boy, it's a quiet group. Let's just look quickly through some of the introductory materials, and I want to mention a few things. One of the fun things about contextual theology is this is one of the few areas where evangelicals have been doing some things. We're still kind of far behind, but at least there's some preliminary studies that have been made in which evangelicals have participated that I think are kind of exciting. On page 1, there is a book by Robin Boyd called India and the Latin Captivity of the Church. Boyd is an evangelical, a member of the Church of England, and for many years a missionary in India. That book is a fascinating study of how Latin has affected the way we read theology. And he talks, for example, you know, the formulations in Western creeds constantly makes use of Latinization, right? We talk about three persons of the Trinity. Now, that's the term we use in contemporary English, but of course the meaning it has now and the meaning it had when it was originally used are radically different, right? is there some way, and his point is that very often the language we use deeply affects the way we do theology. It affects the way we see things. That's the significance of the subtitle of this book, The Cultural Context of the Gospel. It's an interesting book. Make you wrestle a bit with this stuff. Is there a way, what about the Hellenization of Christian theology in the first and second and third centuries? How deeply influenced how deep have the influences be of Hellenization on the writing of the creeds of the early church? Can we really use the Chalcedon Creed anymore? And ask yourself that question if you're thinking about going to use it in a Muslim country. A thinker who has been an evangelical, who's been very involved in these discussions, is Orlando Costas. He was professor for many years at Eastern Baptist Seminary, and he writes as an evangelical from Latin America, very deeply sensitive to some of these issues. Particularly his book, Christ Outside the Gate, tries to start struggling with some of these things and in a way that may be helpful. On page 2, there is a book by Bruce, the author is Bruce Fleming. The book is entitled Contextualization Theology. Do you see that one? That Bruce is a missionary in, I think, Zaire with the Evangelical Free Church. And this is originally his, I think, THM thesis that he wrote at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. I'm putting it, mentioning it to you because it's a good summary of some of the earlier discussions on contextualization. That is up to about 1970. I have a feeling this book came out many years after it was originally written because the book now is terribly out of date. And gives almost no attention at all to the writings of Charles Kraft and others, and they are the major figures in this discussion today. But I think it for some of you, the book may be helpful in just reassuring you of where this is and where people are going. I have a number of disagreements with the book, but you'll hear about them as we go along. But I wanted to mention that to you. There's another very interesting essay on there by Arthur Glasser. Art Glasser used to teach missions here at Westminster, and he is professor of missions at Fuller Theological Seminary. He has an essay, it's only 7 or 8 pages, called Help from an Unexpected Quarter, or The Old Testament and Contextualization. And what he does in that little essay is give you samples. We're going to be dealing with a section of this in the course of how the Bible itself is a contextual document. And he gives illustrations from the Old Testament itself of contextualization. For example, most of you, I suspect, by now have been pretty much enamored of the idea of the Hittite treaty codes and their impact on the idea of the covenant, right? Have you studied that? Well, that's pure contextualization. There's an example of where the Lord himself uses a human context or culture in which to convey his revelation. That's what we're talking about. Gotcha. The thing by Glasser may be very useful. One more I want to mention down there on the list. This is one that has helped me a lot. It's a very striking essay by Phil Holtrop called A Strange Language. Phil Holtrop is a professor at Calvin College. And in that essay, he discusses the nature of truth. And he talks about it in terms, it's a biblical study. He's talking about it in connection with faithfulness, etc. But there's some very interesting biblical insights he has there that some of us can draw from. At the very bottom of the page is another little booklet that I wanted to mention by Bruce Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-L-S. It's called Contextualization, A Theology of Gospel and Culture. Bruce Nichols has been for many years a missionary. He's from New Zealand and a missionary with the Bible and Medical Missionary Fellowship in India. He lives in New Delhi. He's lectured here a number of times. And he is the theological coordinator of the World Evangelical Fellowship. The World Evangelical Fellowship is a world body of evangelical churches drawing everyone together from all over the place. And Bruce is the person who is in charge of the theological discussions within that body. This is a very small book. It's only about like 70 or 80 pages, but it's a very good summary. Most of his illustrations naturally are drawn from India, but what he tries to do is give you a picture of what contextualization is all about. And it's a conservative introduction to the idea, and I think it's a very helpful one. But I wanted to mention that to you as well. Over the page, there's one other title and then an author I want to mention, and we'll take our break. The book by John Stott and Robert Coote, it's called Down to Earth. I'm asking you to read a few pages from the back of that. That book is extremely significant. Somebody has said that that book contains the essays read at a conference sponsored by the Lausanne Committee dealing with the whole question of the relation between the gospel and culture. One author remarked after the consultation, this was probably the first consultation in the entire history of the Christian Church which took as its center this topic. And it's an evangelical group. These papers were read at that consultation. It was, I think, very, very significant meeting. And the report that comes at the end of the book is what I'm asking you to read. It's a summary of all the papers. But the summary was written by John Stott. And you'll recognize a number of the authors in the collection if you ever want to read the thing. But it's significant. The other fellow whose name I want to leave with you is Charles Taber. And you'll notice on the list a number of essays written by him. He's not a book author, but he has written tons of stuff in the whole area of contextualization. He's a professor of world Christianity at the Emmanuel School of Religion in the large city of Johnson City, Tennessee. if some of you don't know where Johnson City is, that's right next to Milligan, Tennessee. It is a theological seminary connected with the Disciples of Christ. And Charles Taber for many years has been working with the American Bible Society as a translations expert. His missionary experiences in the Central African Republic in Bible translation almost all of his life. If you remember, he and Eugene Nida, you may have come across this in other classes in New Testament. Charles Taber and Eugene Nida have written the standard book on translation. He's an extremely capable person and has done, I think, a lot of good writing in this whole area of contextualization. But he's a name you at least ought to sort of keep somewhere in the back of your head, and he writes as an evangelical, though he deplores the term evangelical when it's applied to him. You have to remember, to understand the brother, he comes from the Disciples of Christ. And in that particular tradition, one of the themes of the disciples is no creed but Christ. And so he has violent objections whenever anybody pins labels. Don't call me a liberal, don't call me an evangelical, you know, I'm just a Christian. So remember that if you choose to read it.